Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up.
I'm quite pleased that if precautions are made or taken, that we can get through this and celebrate sport. I'd far rather talk about the concept of unfair advantage in transgender athletes than one person. Overall, it's an easy effort, but it's interspersed with like unbelievable efforts, especially in the mountains.
Well, the Olympic Games is just on a month away and the Tour de France just a few days away. So there is a lot happening in the world of sport as we do our podcast today. And as Professor Ross Tucker and I sit in our studio here in Cape Town, it is raining. It's quite wintry outside, but for all of you that live in the Northern Hemisphere, winter has disappeared. And even in England, they're experiencing some summer conditions, which is quite rare for them in England. So lots to be talking about in this edition. I mean, we could probably do about 3 hours of podcasting today if we were going to talk about all the different aspects of what we can look forward to in the next couple of months. And then, of course, includes the Olympic Games. So we're going to start off by talking very briefly about the Olympic Games and then get on to the subject that is very close to both myself and Ross's heart, and that is the Tour de France. And we always get very excited about the Tour de France and wonder how we're going to get any work done in the afternoons for 21 days of July, which is normally the biggest challenge for us. So let's start off with the Olympics and lots of news around the Olympics. The big news, and I guess there's a couple of big stories hitting the headlines, but let's start off with the happy one, the good one, and that is the fact that 10,000 spectators are going to be allowed to be in the stadiums during the Olympic Games per day, but no cheering or screaming.
Let's hope it's good news. I mean, it could be important for disaster. If you listen to some people talking about how having fans is going to trigger the fourth wave or fifth wave or sixth wave, whatever you pick. But I was pleased that they announced that because I think an Olympic Games in an empty stadium is hollow. Yeah. Even though we've become accustomed to it, I think it still adds a little bit to a special event that you can have some fans. And so they've said 10,000 domestic fans. Yep. Or 50%, whichever comes first. Mm. And that excludes, I was listening last night.
Is that across all the different stadia?
Yeah, so I would imagine, for instance, boxing's not 10,000. Their capacity will be 2,000, so they'll let 1,000 in.
Yeah, right.
Whereas the football, potentially, I don't know how big their swimming venue is.
Yeah.
But certainly the track and field will have 10,000 local fans. But then I was listening last night. There was talk that excludes the VIPs and the sponsors, as one does. Mm-hmm. And there'll be, you can imagine, the Olympics runs on money. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of sponsors who have paid their millions in order for the right to watch the 100-meter final. So they'll be in the stadium in addition to the 10,000. Plus, I think Japan's got a schools program that's going to put kids in there as well. So I'm hopeful that we'll get 20,000 and enough to have an atmosphere.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful it doesn't kick
off. Not an atmosphere that you find on the moon, though.
No. And then, as you say, they've said they're going to be quite strict about no cheering and screaming.
Yeah, so let's just clarify why that is.
I mean, and if anyone will pull that off, it's them, right? I mean, it wouldn't work here.
Yes.
No chance.
The Chinese are very observant of the law.
Even the Japanese.
Even them. Get my countries right. But let's clarify why that is. Why are they not allowing cheering and shouting?
Well, they're taking as many precautions as they can. So the density issue, the 50% and the 10,000, is to allow for spacing. Mm. You don't want too many people in a 100-square-meter space. Mm. And then because it's now known, pretty much unequivocally, that COVID is spread through droplets in the air, aerosol spread, they want to minimize the chances of that. I remember last year, back in March, the first reports came out of a choir practice in Washington causing 80% of the people there to get infected in that first wave. This was when we were all still figuring this thing out. So I think the logic is, the rationale is, don't let people shout, don't let them scream, because that's going to literally, at the risk of being crude, put spittle into the air, and that's what's going to cause infections. I'm not convinced that in an outdoor environment, like in the Olympic Stadium, that's going to be a major thing. We've seen now, even watching the Euros at the moment, the football, rugby's got spectators. They had thousands of people in the US at the recent Indianapolis 500. And I don't know that anyone's linked sports spectating to outbreaks.
And quite a lot of spectators at the French Open as well, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, by the time we got to the final week onwards, it was great to see.
Yeah, it was.
And I, you know, there was a Champions League quarterfinal, or maybe around a 16 tie between, I could be getting this wrong and I apologize, I think it was Atalanta and Valencia. And in hindsight, they reckon that was probably the super spreader that kicked this thing off in Italy.
Yeah.
I would imagine by now, if sports events were doing the same, someone would have documented it. The thing about this Japan announcement is that the medical community in Japan was saying that they don't think that there should be spectators.
Yeah.
So the IOC have acted, and not the IOC only, but the IOC combined with the Japanese organizing committee have acted despite the medical warnings. But I think there's enough from around the world to say that if you are sensible, you can actually all but eliminate the risk in these public places. There's far higher risk, I reckon, of the trains that carry the spectators being the location of a spreading event than the actual stadium itself. So if you want to invest your time and energy, you want to manage the transport to and from the event, not the time at the event. But anyway, so we'll hear a lot of applause.
Polite applause. Polite clapping.
Golf clapping, and maybe someone will invent or come up with a new way of giving the crowd a voice without a voice.
I wonder if a vuvuzela would be safe.
I would imagine
could it collect the spittle?
A vuvuzela seems to me to be the perfect instrument to actually project your spittle into a narrow location. So if you don't know what a vuvuzela is, just look it up. And
look up 2010 World Cup Soccer South Africa.
And then pray that they don't have vuvuzelas in Japan. So I'm excited for it. I think the Olympics, there's so much negativity around it. But you know what I realized is that there always is. Remember in Rio, it was Zika virus.
Zika, yeah.
And everyone was saying, don't have the Olympics because of Zika. There was not a single publicized case as a consequence of those Olympics. Now, I don't think that's going to happen here. I mean, there will be COVID cases. You're in a pandemic. You can't avoid it. But I'm quite pleased that if precautions are made or taken, that we can get through this and celebrate sport. I'm really excited that we can now start for the first time talking about athletes and performances and not COVID catastrophes.
And interesting that you were telling me just before we went on air that they're testing athletes once a day.
Yeah, that's happening.
That's a lot of swabs up your nose.
So there's been, as with everything, there's been a controversy around that because a couple of weeks ago, a very famous scientific journal, I think it was the New England Journal of Medicine, published an opinion piece by a group of public health experts that criticized the IOC's readiness for COVID. Because the IOC's got this policy document which basically says what it will do about COVID and which tests will it use, when will athletes be tested, what happens if the athlete is positive. And one of the things that they came into criticism for, understandably when you hear it, is they wanted, and I think they still do, they want the athletes to sign a waiver that says that if they get COVID, the IOC is not responsible. So they're basically trying to sidestep any legal fallout for putting the athletes in this risky situation. And of course, legal people are going, this is preposterous. You can't put the athletes in a village and then not take on some responsibility for potentially when they get COVID. But anyway, among the things they are doing is daily testing. When there is a positive, the athlete isolates, quarantine for 2 weeks or 10 days. I'm not sure what that is. I stand corrected on that. And then they've got contact tracing, which has been criticized, but they're going to use local tracking devices, you know, like Bluetooth and GPS type devices. And I don't know, the degree to which it's disrupted will be interesting.
Yeah.
The worst case scenario is a Dutch hockey player comes down with COVID. They trace them and it turns out they've been mingling with the Swedish volleyball team, which has been hanging out with the Jamaican track team, which has been interacting with the US track and field team. And now all of a sudden, half the Olympic athletes are.
Yeah.
So that's
It's a possibility, isn't it? I mean, yeah. It is. It's probably an outside possibility, but it is.
But again, like secondary infection and then tertiary infection, you know, as you pass the COVID baton from one to the next, it drops off pretty quickly. So I hope they don't overreact.
Mm.
I know, for instance, they're testing. If you fail that test, if your test is positive, they'll duplicate it because we've seen some false positives before. So I think they're taking precautions. That look to me, they sound sensible. Japan now is on 350 cases a day, which in a country that size is low.
Yeah,
and I don't want to jinx it, and I certainly don't want to belittle what they're dealing with, but this feels eminently doable to me. As long as everyone is sensible and keeps their mouths shut at the stadiums. So I'm excited. I'm finally, you know, a month to go. It's real. It's going to happen. And now we can enjoy it, I hope.
Yeah.
Without a COVID.
And as far as I know, I haven't seen any athletes that have not decided not to go because they're concerned about safety. Have you seen anything? I haven't. Having read up a lot about the Olympics and lots of news, nobody's decided not to go for safety purposes.
The vaccine has arguably saved the day.
Yes, well, most of the athletes have been vaccinated. Right. So, not all of them, though.
Yeah, so for instance, I was reading the IOC's bought thousands of vaccine doses separate from the world's allocation because that was a big thing. Like, you know, even here in South Africa, what are we on, like 5%?
Yeah, something like that.
It's dreadful.
5% of the only over 60s.
Yeah, something crazy like that. I mean, it'll be Paris by the time.
Yeah, but all our South African athletes are getting vaccinated.
Right, and so that's because the IOC's gone in parallel with governments and their normal responses. They've added to the vaccine pool so that it's not taking away, which I think was important. I know Canada got Pfizer and so on. So that's arguably saved that. Mm. Over the weekend, the Ugandan team arrived in Tokyo. They'd all been tested when they left and apparently all vaccinated before they left, and one of them failed the test on landing. So whether that's a false positive on the Tokyo side or whether that's a false negative on the Uganda side, I don't know. But that was the news thing. Oh, a crisis.
Mm.
My assessment of it is, oh, good, the system seems to be working.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I get that it's just sport, but it's also not just sport.
No, for sure.
And I'm pleased that they're going to get – I hope they pull it off.
It's quite a sell, you know, run a good time, qualify for the Olympics, you get a free trip to Tokyo and a vaccine in the process.
And a vaccine. I don't know. If you're listening to this, you're likely to agree, but I think the world needs a good Olympic Games.
Yeah.
I mean, we're biased, and yes, it's a massive commercial entity and it's corrupt and whatever else, but come the 23rd of July,
it's good to watch.
It's going to be great.
Yeah, exactly. So talking about the Olympics, one of the other big stories that's been doing the rounds over the last couple of days was the announcement that Laurel Hobart, who was a transgender athlete, had been chosen for the New Zealand weightlifting team. And when we spoke about this in a podcast a month ago, I knew that there was a good chance she was being chosen, but you were saying that it was almost a fait accompli that she was going to be chosen for that team.
Yeah.
And of course, the controversy around that now has exploded, and we've seen a huge amount of people listening to our podcast we did on that a couple of months ago, and people are really taking a lot of interest into why this is such a big story, and it is massive.
I've done a couple interviews the last day with BBC, Sky, a couple of local stations here in South Africa, and a TV station, because it's now... You see, and I'm almost conflicted a little bit because I don't like the fact that now we talk about it with reference to a specific person, because that's quite unfair. I mean, even on the Sky News interview, they said, does Laurel Hobart have an advantage? And I'd far rather talk about the concept of unfair advantage in transgender athletes than one person.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we've all seen over the last few years, people don't really understand the reality of an issue until it's a real issue. So in that regard, Hobart's selection and presence in Tokyo almost as the literal personification of the controversy will help the conversation. So it has been a massive story, and once she'd qualified by virtue of meeting the international weightlifting requirements to be selected, New Zealand was never going to admit her. I mean, on what basis would they leave her out? So that was fully expected. But once it happened, now it becomes a tangible thing instead of a conceptual thing. And that might help. It's going to be unpleasant already now, the last day or so. It's really kicked off. And if she wins a medal, I mean, and that's an outside chance, because of the way the selection works. She might only be the ninth.
But she's been shunned by her fellow athletes, hasn't she?
Some of them have spoken out. And if there's one thing I've learned in the last couple of years is if a few athletes are speaking out, then many, many don't agree.
Yeah.
Because the athletes are really scared to speak up because there is so much social pressure and potential hostility, loss of sponsorships, accusations that will come your way for speaking against almost the social wind direction.
Yeah.
Even if you're correct in the context of sport, and I believe they are. So the fact that a few have spoken suggests to me that there's pretty widespread opposition.
Yeah.
And you know, like it's a obscure trivia question, but the way the qualification works is you qualify through regions. And so the person who is displaced is another Pacific Island lifter. And apparently it's a Tongan lifter, 21-year-old called Kuanini Manumua, who would otherwise have been selected for the Olympic Games. So anyway, Hubbard might only be the ninth or tenth best lifter in the world, but because of this qualification, she might be the fourth or fifth best lifter in Tokyo.
Yeah.
Because some countries can't select their second and third best lifters.
Yeah.
Which means she could win a medal.
Yeah.
Then it'll be even easier to say she's displaced a medalist.
Yeah.
But right now, she's displaced another lifter.
Yeah.
And that's the issue. That's the inclusion-exclusion dilemma
that
we covered in that podcast.
Well, if you want to have a look at that podcast, that was sent out on the 20th of May, so just on a month ago, and you can have a look at that. It was entitled, Why Transgender Athletes Threaten Fairness in Women's Sport, and you can get some real detail as to what we've been talking about, and particularly the case around Laurel Hobart, because she was one of the people that we talked about around this whole concept. So,
So if you're listening to this without context, go back and have a listen. And I don't want to go through everything again about male-female difference, biological advantage, why it exists, how it's not removed. It's all in that podcast. But suffice to say that fairness is going to be the big story. I mean, barring a massive doping controversy or a COVID catastrophe, this will be the biggest controversy of Tokyo.
Yeah.
So arguably we'll speak about
it. We'll probably see more spectators and TV watchers watching the weightlifting channel when this is on, purely because it's going to be a story of interest, isn't it? I mean, as much as these things are controversial and there's a huge amount of debate around them, they do create a lot of interest in the sport as a result of this.
Mm, the actions of her competitors will be interesting.
Yeah.
A few people have said on social media that they should all refuse to compete. I mean, that's not going to happen. Like athletes aren't wired that way, no matter what they think. Mm-hmm. So in addition to the social issues. And I'd hope people will be decent enough to be civil.
Yeah.
But, wow, based on what I've seen in the last few days.
Based on what we know about Caster Semenya.
it's going to be ugly.
There's a couple of other stories. I mean, in purely in the South African context, obviously Caster Semenya is a big story here in South Africa, and she's battling to qualify for the 5,000, which is the only event that she can actually compete in after not being able to compete in the 800.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Wade van Niekerk, who in 2017 did a very serious job on his knee playing a celebrity rugby match.
Yep.
And I think he broke his ACL joint. And
tore the ACL.
Yeah, pretty serious. Yeah. He seems to be back in reasonably good condition and could be a medalist.
Yeah, he ran a race the other day in Europe and he finished second behind a guy called Anthony Zambrano, who's a Colombian who was second in the 400 at the World Champs. He beat him by a hundredth of a second. I think Finneke ran 44.56, which is decent.
Yeah.
He needs to find probably a second. It's hard to see that Olympic final being won in a time slower than 43.5. The last World Champs was won by Stephen Gardner in 43.48, if memory serves me.
Yeah.
You can all write in and tell me I'm wrong. But he won it by a lot. The guy Zambrano ran 44.1 something. So historically, like a mid-43 wins the Olympics. I mean, obviously, 2016 was a 43.03, but that was exceptional. So if he can find another second, then for sure. But can he? That seems a lot to me. But a medal is certainly there. No one knows what Stephen Gardner's condition is. He pulled up injured in a race a month or so ago. Michael Norman, who was last year's fastest man and messed his taper up. Sorry, 2019. Really messed his taper up. He won the US trials at the weekend in 44.04 and his trajectory looks good. So he's probably the guy to beat.
Mm.
But that'll be competitive. And I mean, we obviously South Africans, so we're looking at where our medals are going to come from. That's one potential because, yeah, Semenya was worth 2 medals and now none. Because, that's an interesting one actually because, as you said, she for a time was trying to earn the 200 and was quite close to the Olympic standard there. And then decided because of the risk of injury to go to the 5 and is nowhere near the Olympic standard there.
Yeah.
She ran the other night 15:57, which is 47 seconds off that standard. I mean, that's not...
Yeah. So, she's not going to make the final.
She's not going to make the games.
Yeah.
The start line.
Well, if she was in the semi-final, she wouldn't make the final.
Oh, she'd be... The way they're running now, they'll run 14:20-something. Mm-hmm. She'll be lapped once and...
Yeah.
I mean, she'll be on the back straight... A lap behind. So, anyway, it's unlikely.
It's tragic in many ways.
So
anybody who's been watching the Caster Semenya saga over the last decade, it is tragic.
Of interest is that one of the other athletes who was caught up in that whole DSD policy is Francine Niyonsaba, and she's qualified in the 5.
Right.
So, unless Burundi doesn't pick her, and I can't see why they wouldn't, she'll be in Tokyo, which means. Again, you'll have that weird paradox of an athlete who's illegal in the 1500 running a 5K.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's
so many stories outside of just performance-based stories. So for wherever you are in the world, I'm sure that we all have our favorite sports. I love watching the swimming. I love watching the athletics and all the – and particularly I love the marathon and the Olympics. I find that, you know, we've talked about this in this podcast before. When it comes to competing in events, particularly track events, when you don't have – pace setters and people who are setting paces for, like you see in some of the European events, it's championship racing at its best. And what you see on the track is one-on-one competition, and whoever is the best on the night is the winner of the gold or the silver and the bronze. It's very different from what we see in a more sort of the events that happen in Oslo and the Diamond League, everything's been set up for fast times. And, you know, you and I have often discussed this, that racing, particularly when it comes to any kind of track and field stuff, it's actually the racing that's exciting, not necessarily the time. You know, how close was that person? I mean, we watched a couple of weeks ago a 5,000 where we saw Cheptegei finishing 5th. In that event, in a great 5,000. So that's going to be an event that's going to be well worth watching
All those middle distance races, you know, 800, 15, 5, 10, they all are fascinating for that reason.
Yeah.
And
Jakob Ingebrigtsen is going to be somebody to watch as well, isn't he?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see which event he picks.
Five. Is he going for the 10 as well?
No, he's likely to go 15, actually, 1,500. 15, five. Not the double.
Not the double.
It's so weird. This year they've made the doubles really difficult to do.
Yeah.
Which is a shame because the iconic athletes of the Olympic Games are always those who do the doubles.
Yeah.
You know, whether it was Wente Reyna style, I don't think he didn't do it, but he was known as a 400, 800 guy. It's the Coevet rivalry from the 80s. It was the Bekele and even Mo Farah. I don't know his name on my lips, but there you go. It's always those guys who become the icons, the images of the Olympics.
Yeah.
And for some reason, they've made it so difficult. So, for instance, even in the 2-4, like Shaunae Miller-Weibo was a potential double medal winner there. And she's chosen the 2, not the 4, because it's just the way they've done their program, I just don't understand it. And it's the same for the 15-5 double, and it's the same for the 5-10 double on both sides. Like, so, yeah, we've been denied the opportunity to see these guys in women twice.
Yeah.
Which is a pity.
Now, scheduling is obviously very complicated because there's lots of factors at play. They don't necessarily going to favour one or two athletes that might have a chance of a double.
I sort of get that, but if you've had a schedule in 96 that allowed a 200, 400 double, and you were there, you saw both Perek and Johnson, men and women, did that double.
That's right.
We've had 1,500, 5,000 doubles. It's rare.
Yeah.
Al Guerrouz was the one who did that.
So they just keep the schedules the same, ideally.
Yeah, and I suppose it's got to do with the facility. Like you can't have maybe hammer throw in a distance race because of the danger. I don't know. Or if it's a TV thing. But anyway, it's a shame because we won't necessarily see Ingebrigtsen in one of the two events he might have won. So I think he'll pick the 15. But anyway, what would I would have picked the 5. Tactical race like that, the 1,500 guy is going to win it.
Yeah. Hey, it's fantastic to watch as well.
And then you say to Cheptegei, if you want to run 12:41 and from the front and burn me off, then go for it.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you run 12:55, I'm going to sit on and beat you. Anyway,
yeah.
Fun times. We'll see.
So much stuff to talk about, and we'll certainly try and bring you some more highlights. Our goal is to try and interview some of the specialists in the individual events that we are going to see, hopefully with some rowing and some gymnastics. And so particularly gymnastics, actually, we're struggling to find somebody who would really be an expert to talk to us about gymnastics. So if you know anybody, let us know on our Twitter feed, and maybe we can get hold of somebody who can explain some of the ins and outs of gymnastics.
If you're listening to this and you can explain simply and technically, which is paradoxical, why Simone Biles does things that no one else can do,
yes,
then please tell us, because we want to speak to you.
Yes, there we go.
The other event, by the way, and I've got a lead on it from a journalist I spoke to, is climbing. New at the Olympics.
Yes.
Fascinating how they train. Finger strength. How do you measure the strength of fingers? And do you need long arms or short arms? Anyway, we'll do that one too.
That's good. We're looking forward to that.
Yeah.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Right, so let's move on to a subject or a sporting event that's a little bit closer to us than the Olympic Games, although that is pretty close to us now. And that is the Tour de France, which is something both Ross and I love watching, and it affects our work schedules, particularly in the afternoons. And when the big hill stage is on, I have to take leave. Let's just have a quick look at the Tour de France this year. Obviously, it starts in Brittany, four stages in Brittany, and then they've got two time trials, a double ascent of Mont Ventoux, and they're visiting Andorra this year. It looks like the kind of event which doesn't necessarily suit climbers, because we've had Tour de France in the past which are like very heavily favoured.
With very few time trial K's. Yeah. This one's got 61, just over 60 time trial climbers. Yeah. So
from the outset, and looking at some of the people that are being touted as favourites here, it looks like a more all-rounders Tour de France. And I worry a little bit that because we're not going to have as many of those hilltop finishes, Mont Ventoux being an example, we were not actually finishing on Mont Ventoux, even though the race goes up there twice in one day. You miss that drama of those hilltop finishes, because once there's a descent on the other side, there's always a chance of somebody being able to motor back with the team. So, I mean, what's your assessment to looking at the route and looking at what we've seen in the past, the Tour de France?
Pretty much what you said. I think there are three summit finishes, right? There's one in the Alps. They finish on Tiens, the ski resort. And then there's a double finish in the Pyrenees. Or is there a third one? I forget. But I know there are five Pyrenean days and only two in the Alps. So this year's tour is a little bit light on the mountains in the first while, and then it backloads them nicely. So the Wednesday, the last Wednesday of the tour, features a triple climb finish, which is – looks like a really decisive stage, maybe. And then the Thursday is the Tourmalet Luzardiden climb. So that's really where, if I'm a climber, that's where I'm, you know, holding out for. Having said all that, if this tour had a lot of mountain finishes, we'd still be talking about the same four or five guys.
Yes.
As we're talking about anyway. But there are a couple of guys, Lopez, for instance, who recently, there was a race on Mont Ventoux. I don't know if you saw that. He won that race with the fastest climb of Mont Ventoux since 2004, which says a great deal about his climbing legs and his lungs. So he's a guy who probably would expect to lose minutes in the 60Ks of time trialing. So he has to liven the tour up before the finishing summits.
Yeah.
So that's where maybe you start to see attacks 5K from the summit of Mont Ventoux, even though there's a 20K descent down to the finish line.
Yeah.
Because I'm like you, when you don't finish at the top, you just introduce a necessary cautiousness, caution, conservatism.
Yeah.
Where everyone wants to watch one another, and you know, if you gain 30 seconds, you're not holding on to that.
No.
If five guys are hunting you on the descent, unless you are seriously taking risks, and I can't see.
Yeah. Well, descending is becoming a bit of an art now. Mm. I mean, they've stopped the different positions and they're sitting on top of the top bar. It's not as aggressive as it used to be, but certainly but
that,
is a skill.
That favors a group of four or five, I'd have thought, rather than the guy out in front. Anyway, I think it's an intriguing tour. The pattern will be interesting, you know. Because you got the first time trial on the Wednesday.
Yep.
And it's long enough that there could be some big gaps between guys having bad days. You know, if you are a climber and you don't do a decent time trial, you might find yourself a minute, minute and a half down. And that's a pretty big gap. Then again, Pogacar lost a minute and a half last year on stage seven. And he, as you know, caught it up and won.
Well, I mean, let's just have a brief look at the first week. And obviously, we're going to sort of keep up to date with all the new stuff as it's happening throughout the 3 weeks or 21 stages. So the first couple of days, what's very interesting is that it almost resembles a bit of a classics finish because you've got two small hill finishes on day one and day two, which will hopefully really favour the punches.
Yeah, and so Alaphilippe would be saying,
Julian's going to love that.
I'm going to be in yellow by Sunday night. You know? Like that said, Mathieu van der Poel is going to be saying the same.
Absolutely.
And potentially, and this is one of the questions, is like, how good is Van Aert going to be?
Yeah.
You know, I was looking earlier this year at Tirreno Adriatico. Van Aert won the first stage, second on stage two. I think he was third on stage three. He got another top three and then he won the final time trial.
Yeah.
So he was in outrageous condition. He's since had an appendix operation, and I saw him saying the other day that he doesn't believe that he's in the same condition as last year, and his focus is not going to be the green jersey.
Okay.
It'll be most likely one or two stage wins, protecting Roglic, and then maybe helping Roglic in the mountains. But yeah, there's four or five guys who could win. I think on Saturday, stage one finishes on a 3K climb at 5.7%.
Yep. Right.
And on Sunday is a 2K climb at 6.5-7%.
Yeah.
But with like 10% ramps at the beginning of each.
Yeah.
So that's really great for the Alaphilippe, Van der Poel, Van Aert types. We also know Roglic likes those.
Yeah.
It was at Flèche Wallonne earlier this year. In fact, we were sitting in this office watching that together. And remember, he went for it and he blew everyone away.
Yeah.
But then blew himself up with 100 to go and Alaphilippe caught him. So it'll be interesting to see, like, will Roglic and Pogacar go for those time bonuses in the first week?
And both of them are capable of actually doing well.
Yeah, because then, of course...
They've got puncher-like qualities themselves.
Well, Pogacar won a flat sprint against Alaphilippe the week after Alaphilippe beat Roglic in the Flèche Wallonne. So these guys, that was at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I think Pogacar out-sprinted the field.
Yeah.
So they could all, if they wanted to, go for it. The question is, and this happened in the Giro, was remember Bernal and Evenepoel in the first week went for some of the time bonus sprints, is do you want to burn your matches on day one and two? And I mean, these guys are so well conditioned that they can do it, but you can't do it all the time. And so physiologically speaking, the tour is about physiology management. It's a budget, except your budget has two or three currencies. You know, there's your anaerobic sprint budget, which says that you've got 3 45 seconds efforts in your legs in the whole race. There's your sustainable power budget, which says you've got an hour and a half of steady climbing at 6.1 watts a kilo. And then there's the endurance budget to cover the other 3,000 kilometers in between. And how do you allocate that over the course of 3 weeks is really interesting. Bad days, as we saw last year, could cost you a minute and a half. Good days might gain you 30 seconds. So you have to be quite careful.
I think what's interesting to sort of explain to those that don't watch as much cycling as maybe the rest of us do, is that what's interesting about the Tour de France, and we've looked at heart rates of pro riders over the last sort of year or so to see how they perform in those big stage events. So when we look at a race like the Tour de France, not every stage is hard for every rider.
No.
For a lot of those riders, they're literally saving themselves for the stages that matter. For those who want to win a stage, they will target a certain stage. They will say, right, stage five looks good for me. If I can get in the break, I've got a chance of winning that. For the GC contenders, it's about literally preserving any kind of energy expenditure until it is absolutely needed and they're protected by the team. So it's not like every racer is racing flat out for 4 hours a day. They're cruising along at a relatively comfortable pace for pro riders.
Yeah, we're talking 80 hours of more, actually. And out of those 80 hours, only 1.5 are decisive to the race.
Yeah.
And so the question is, did you allocate your 1.5 hours correctly? So that's exactly right. And at the risk of like majorly dumbing it down, the peloton cruising along at 40K an hour in a bunch on a flat day, the guys in the middle are just being sucked along at 90 watts. I remember in the Giro, there was actually a conversation because they showed a stat, and I wrote this for your magazine, where Bernal had been going, I think, 43K an hour for the first hour at an average watts of 90.
Yeah.
And people said, well, is that all it takes? Like, I could do this. Well, if they let you, yes. Because what they didn't pick up on is that the peak power for 30 seconds was like 900.
Yeah.
So what's happening is there's an attack. The brake is trying to get formed. The peloton doesn't like the composition of the brake, and they respond to those attacks. And now all of a sudden, Bernal, who weighs like 50-something kilos soaking wet, has to produce 15 watts a kilogram for a few seconds. And if he doesn't do that, then he's in for a long day out.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. The point is that, yes, it's overall, it's an easy effort.
Yes.
But it's interspersed with like unbelievable efforts, especially in the mountains and the time trials, because we're going to see 40 minutes at 5.9 to 6 watts a kilo. We're going to see 20 minutes at 6.2, 6.3. And we're going to see these first two stages. I mean, they're going to be one at 8 to 9 watts a kilogram for the last 2-3 minutes.
Yeah.
So that's when...
That's when you're going to see the power.
That's when the numbers get a bit scary for the mortals.
Because I think the perception that we often have with Tour de France riders is that they're capable of a long sustained efforts, but actually what they're doing is they're actually not. They're more capable of short sustained efforts to be able to maintain and have the right to ride for those long sustained efforts.
Right, and that's where you get like the physiology that's like eyebrow raising is when you get people who can do both.
Yeah.
Because now you've got guys who are sitting on the front for 30 minutes on a finishing climb at 8%, cruising along at 5.9, 6 watts a kilo. But then 2 days earlier, they were sprinting at 1,500 watts for 20 seconds. And so that's where you get like this weird physiology, you know. And it is interesting, and it does raise certain questions. But certainly you get that range more on a bicycle than you do running. I mean, you're never going to see Usain Bolt running a 5K.
No.
In fact, you'll never see Usain Bolt running a 400-meter race. Okay, maybe
he could.
He did do those. But an 800, they drop off precipitously.
Mm.
And similarly, Kipchoge is not matching up well in a 100. Mm. But in cycling, you get a bigger range.
Mm.
But you're right. It's a story with like many different subplots. And if you and we'll try and shed light on some of those for you over the course of the race, hopefully.
So let's talk about some of the favorites. And of course, last year the winner was Tadej Pogacar. And we've heard via the grapevine that his numbers are better than they were for last year's tour. But let's face it, last year's tour, he wasn't the favorite until that second last stage. He only really won it against all expectations on that second last stage.
He had an unusual tour because he was properly under the radar.
Yeah.
In part... And I mean, it's not a good thing, but he lost, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, he lost a minute and a half on stage 7 when he was caught up by a combination of a mechanical and a surge on the front in some crosswinds that split the peloton. So he came into the finish that day a minute and a half down. The next day he attacked on the parasword and he got 40 seconds back, and then he kept chipping away. Now, it's interesting to speculate, and these are ifs and buts, but if he hadn't lost the 90 seconds, then would the likes of Roglic been as generous allowing him to attack? And in fact, would that have made a difference? Because he was just really good. Sometimes it's not like I'm giving you permission to attack me, you just actually are faster than me. But he, you know, the benefit of losing that time is that he never had to control the race. He could, and he was clever. He's tactically very sharp, I think, because he didn't have a team. Remember last year it was about Roglic and Jumbo Visma.
Yeah.
Pogacar just surfed their wheels, and he managed to always be in the right place at the right time, pick up the time that he needed, and then, of course, he produced that incredible time trial at the end. This year, the situation is different, I think. I don't see
him. He still doesn't have a particularly strong team, though.
Certainly stronger than last year. Like they've had
McNulty. But not in the same level of Ineos Grenadiers or...
No, but no one's there. I mean, Ineos Grenadiers, I mean, that's...
They've got three contenders.
Yeah, the Tour de France the Tour de France is going to be run by a locomotive on the front wearing black and red or whatever colour they've got.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. Dave Railsford said, by the way, we have to change our tactics. It's like, Dave, just could you stop lying for 1 second? Like, this is what you've done for 10 years, is just put a team on the front at 5.9 watts a kilo and nobody can attack you. That's what you're going to do this year too. Like, there's no doubt that's going to be the approach. But, yeah, he's got a stronger team now this year with UAE. They've certainly built a team around him. So there's going to be pressure on him. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. Remember, Bernal won it in 2019. And suddenly there was pressure. And we saw that he didn't wear that so well. He was unlucky with injuries. But it's hard to defend for that reason. So
there's a waste of expectation, I think.
Exactly.
To some extent, you realize that, you know, last year Pogacar was somebody that if he'd won and he'd done well, it was, you know, he'd done it again, expectations relatively.
Because of his age.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Young man.
So that he doesn't have that luxury this year. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. He has been training in Sestriere.
Yep.
Which you say is around about 2,000 meters above sea level. I mean, let's talk very briefly about that. Why do athletes train at altitude for events that are taking place at relatively low levels?
Well, for the tour, two reasons. One is obvious, is that when you ride the tour, you're going to be at 2,000 meters quite a lot. I think this year there are three climbs that get up to 2,000.
Mont Ventoux, only in the second week, really, don't they?
Mont Ventoux's at 1,900. The Alps takes them to close to 2. I think Teens is just on 2. The highest point is 2,400, I think we saw.
Yeah.
And when you start getting that high, I mean, the air is thin. So what's happening there is the partial pressure of the air is lower. And so it is more difficult for oxygen to get into your lungs. As a result, you have less oxygen in the blood and therefore less at the muscles. And so performance is compromised by altitude to the extent of, and this is in non-adapted people, for every 1,000 meters you go up, your maximal capacity drops by about 6%. So by the time you're at the top of Mont Ventoux or the Tourmalet, which is just over 2,000 meters, Lizard Edens 1,700, your VO2 max is going to be about 10 to 12% lower than it was down the bottom.
But what I guess the question I'm asking is they're only really getting to those high mountains in stage 7 onwards.
Yes.
Does the effect of training at altitude still carry itself forward?
Right. So that's why I said, remember, there's two reasons. So the one is directly, if I don't learn to cope with lower PO2s, then that altitude effect on those days is going to hurt me more than if I'm adapted.
Right.
So an altitude adapted person is not losing 6% per 1,000 meters. They're losing 2 or 3. And so therefore, their performance impairments on the Tourmalet, Mont Ventoux and so on are going to be suppressed compared to the guy who's not adapted. Makes sense? So there's a direct benefit.
And he said that adaption will last long enough than a week or so.
Yeah, because, and again, this is why they always say the Colombians come into their own in the high mountains, because that adaptation for them is basically permanent. They've got high altitude.
Well, they were born there,
High altitude ancestry. And we've got data, incidentally, on Kenyans that shows that when you have ancestry, you have literally an improved ability to supply oxygen to your brain. Like, so a sea level native deoxygenates their brain, which is not good. Whereas the Kenyans, even at maximal exercise, their capacity to keep the oxygen supply almost normal is much better.
So it's almost genetic.
Well, it's genetic and inherited over many generations of genetics, which is really very interesting. So high altitude ancestry, more than just living, makes a difference. So that means that Pogacar, they could live in Sestriere, but they may never fully overcome that difference. But you overcome it enough that it doesn't become decisive. But the indirect reason, this is I think what you were alluding to, is there is the school of thought that if you train at altitude and you come back to sea level, you get a benefit in performance over and above training at sea level.
Mm-hmm.
The mechanism for that, and in fact, even the existence of this is contentious. One of the things that happens at altitude, and you'd know this because you've done it yourself, is if we go up to Johannesburg, which is at 1600, you just can't train very hard.
Yeah.
Like you're limited by the thin air.
Yeah.
And so your quality of
training. There's not enough petrol coming into the engine.
Pretty much, yes. If petrol is oxygen, that's exactly what's happening. Yeah. And so your quality of training drops. And so what you gain, because the theory, remember, is that the low oxygen levels in the air, the PO2, is going to trigger your body to make more red blood cells. And so you're going to get these adaptations that you're going to hold with you when you go back down to sea level. It's almost like natural enhanced blood cell production, which is the same thing you're doing when you dope, but naturally, right?
Yeah.
The problem is that what you gain in terms of red blood cells, you might lose in terms of training quality and neuromuscular adaptations and whatever else goes into cycling performance.
So if you're going really hard and you have more oxygen available than you would have to, right, at your event sea level, you could potentially push your muscles harder to harder efforts at sea level.
At sea level,
so it's, yeah, a case of sleeping. What's it, sleeping high, training low.
And that's why, yeah, that system evolved exactly. Mm. Was now we could sleep high and get the oxygen benefit for the blood cells. But when we wanted to do the hard training, we go down where there's more oxygen in the air and we can still hit the targets. I remember going to a conference in Colorado Springs where the US and Olympic biathlon champion and his coach were speaking, and they were talking about how they would plan. If you were doing short intervals, you had to be at sea level because that all that matters was intensity.
Yeah.
If you weren't hitting, and this was skiing now, cross-country skiing, if you weren't hitting your targets for those 2 or 3 minutes, you're wasting the session. If you're doing medium length or long intervals, you do them at middle altitudes. But if you're doing slow base mileage, you go to high altitudes. So you fit the training to the altitude. Now, that's the paradigm that's then used. And so if US swimming, for instance, they do altitude camps at very specific times of the year because it's when they're going to be doing long, slow distance miles in the pool. When they introduce the speed work and the intervals, now we have to start thinking about phasing out altitude and focusing on quality. So it makes sense, right? You match, yeah, the training requirement, and it comes back to what we've spoken about in the last few podcasts, that concept of specificity.
Mm.
Is you're looking for a specific benefit, and the environment facilitates that or stops it, as the case may be.
So the question is, I mean, there is technology now with these altitude tents and hyperbaric chambers and that sort of thing. Why does a guy like, I mean, I suppose we just have to hypothesize about these things, but why does a guy like Pogacar go to Sestriere when he could sleep in a altitude tent and live at the coast?
Because he wants the terrain.
Okay.
So that counts. I mean, Sestriere is a climb. You may know it if you've been following it. So Armstrong emerged as a tour rider by winning a stage on, well, he won a time trial, son, but that was when everyone said, hey, this guy can climb.
Yeah.
The story is told slightly differently if you're David Walsh or some of those French journalists who said, whoa, this guy can climb. Yeah. Something is wrong here. But you're looking for terrain. I mean, you've got alpine passes everywhere you look. I mean, no matter which way you go, it's down and then up.
Yeah.
So that counts for a lot. And that's why they go to Mount Teed, I think, is where a lot of them go in Tenerife for the similar reason.
Mm.
Amazing terrain to train in. Plus the fact that you get a camp. You get to go away with your team. You get to recon maybe some of the climbs. I don't know whether they were doing that now or earlier. I know Roglic was doing recons of certain stages, the time trial. The day after he won the Basque Country, there was footage of him time trialing the Tour de France's opening TT. So they do it for that reason. And then, as I mentioned, the direct benefit is you have to cycle at those altitudes in order to teach the body what it feels like to cycle with that little air around. Mm. Because, you know, there's going to be 5 occasions in the Tour de France where you can't avoid it. So you might as well get accustomed to that stress. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Let's look at some other favorites. One of the interesting things about both Pogacar and Roglic is that neither of them did the traditional warm-up events, the Tour de Suisse and the Dauphiné. It's obviously been talked about on every single cycling website that I've been looking at the last couple of months. But the idea that somebody rests before a big event like the Tour de France, it seems unusual because to some extent – Chris Froome used to say this, you go into the Tour de France slightly undertrained so that you kind of use the Tour to build yourself up. That's why the Tour is designed the way it is.
Mm.
What do you think the logic behind Roglic and Pogacar not racing those events are? And is it an experiment of two?
Well, yeah. I mean, it is because when you've read all those articles, and I have too, but I've got so many numbers jumbled in my head. When was the last time a Tour when it didn't come from a Dauphiné or Swiss Tour?
I don't know, but I mean it's well known. Yeah.
It's a long time ago. They've always
the Dauphiné winner is always right up there in the Tour de France.
So. Yeah, or you at least have to do the Dauphiné. You'll finish maybe third or fourth, but like you've done it at least.
Yeah.
So you asked what's the logic?
Yeah. So I mean, what are the well, we know that keeping the legs turning, being competitive, being race fit. Is there such thing as race fit?
Yeah. So semi tongue in cheek, depending on your level of cynicism, you might have reasons to argue for why someone would want to escape
let's avoid the cynical approach.
I think Roglic has said that he knows how to prepare for these races. He does have a remarkable track record of consistent, strong finishes. I don't think he's ever not finished in a podium position unless he's crashed out and not finished the race at all. And even when that happened, like we saw in Paris-Nice this year, he was leading the race when it happened. Last year's Dauphiné, I mean, he still finished the race, but last year's Dauphiné pulled out while in the leader's jersey. So he's shown, I think, consistently that he knows how to prepare. And I think after last year, he's probably said, I got it slightly wrong last year. I didn't have the necessary power by maybe one day. And so I'm going to go away this year and consolidate how I know to prepare. That can be the only rationale, is we believe that we can condition better in training than races would have allowed us to.
Yeah.
Because of control. I mean, that's what it boils down to. I've got the control now to do a 20K climb at the tempo that I think I need to do. Whereas in a race, you can't predict because you have to respond to other people and be reactive. So I think that's the main reason there. For Pogacar, he did the Tour of Slovenia, which was, I think, a fairly soft race when you look at who he beat.
Yeah.
But there might have been,
wasn't there, yeah.
There might have been personal, potentially sponsorship reasons to do that rather than the other races. But also, I think it boils down to, I think, the same thing, is that by doing that race, you're not going to be exposed to massively unpredictable situations.
Yeah.
You're not going to be attacked on days when you're potentially not super strong because your training's not right. So let's rather control as much as we can. And I think what it speaks to is that in the sport, they used to race to get fit. I think that the sophistication of preparation now is that they don't think they need racing to get fit.
Yeah.
They think that they can simulate it well enough because of power meters, because of indoor trainers, because they've got squatted environments, that they can actually do it without needing to race.
Yeah. I think what's interesting is that last year, before the Tour de France, obviously Roglic was very competitive at the Dauphiné, and therefore that was a good build-up. And let's face it, he didn't win the Tour de France, but he was pretty close to winning the Tour de France.
Super close.
It was one of those things where I kind of look at this, and my gut feeling is 10 weeks of non-racing. The last time he raced was in Liège, Bastogne-Liège, where he got dropped.
Yeah,
Pogacar won. Psychologically, he's on the back foot going into the Tour because of, you know, Pogacar's having beaten him.
Yeah, although he'll say, hey, Basque Country was the last Tour that I rode.
Yeah.
True. Multi-stage race, and still, look at how I went there. You know? So he won that. But yes, remember last year, though, we said, even during the Tour, okay, and I'm not going to be all Captain Hindsight here and say, oh, we knew that he wouldn't win. But we did. I distinctly remember saying that, like, the one thing about Roglic is he always has a bad day, which he did. And then he had it again in the Vuelta, but he hung on.
Mm.
But also how much he races. Like he
raced a lot.
Unbelievable amounts.
Yeah, he did. Yes.
And last year was a super compressed season because of COVID and the lockdown. But when it started up, I mean, Roglic was basically in every single, like, you couldn't avoid the guy.
Yeah.
And I think maybe they've said, you know what, like, all the eggs in one basket now. We believe we know how to prepare and we're going to go away. And I think Pogacar's saying the same thing.
Yeah.
Remember, Pogacar raced UAE, and that was the first big race of the year. Then Adriatica. So he's also had a long season, but with relatively sparse racing. And I think it says both those guys are backing their conditioning more than their race specific fitness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the guys who did the traditional warm-up. Yeah. And of course, Richie Porte, who, I want to put it out there, I think he's my pick for the Tour de France, actually. I think he raced the Dauphiné really well, and he's got a lot of experience. And he's kind of always been the always man of Grand Tour racing. Never quite there. He's had having some unfortunate accidents in the past when he's been up there, thereabouts. He's one of the, you know, three guys on the Ineos Grenadiers team with Carapaz and Geraint Thomas as a potential winner there. The Grenadiers are interesting because they literally do have three leaders, even though Geraint Thomas has been shown and has been announced as the leader of the team.
Yeah, and that's always interesting. I mean, remember when it was Movistar, they had Valverde, Quintana, and Landa all in the same Tour, and it ended up being a total disaster because they couldn't allocate resources properly. And so that's the danger for Ineos, because, you know, what happens if Thomas is gapped in the Alps? Now, do Carapaz and Port wait because they're going to go for it, or they're going to let him? And I'm sure they will. They'll just let the race unfold the way that it's meant to. And if Thomas can't fulfill the leader's obligations, he loses the leadership. But that potentially creates some tricky situations. You know, the first time trial, you would imagine Carapaz loses time to both of Thomas and Port.
Yes.
But which of Thomas and Port? Mm. If one of those has a particularly average day and loses, say, 30, 40 seconds to the other, does that change the hierarchy and the structure? So there's some interesting tactical questions there. You know, when Bernal won the Giro, he was supported by Danny Martinez.
Yeah.
And you'll remember that in the last week of the Giro, Bernal was dropped by Yates, and then in another occasion, Caruso was going away from him. There was never a doubt that Martinez was going to stay with Bernal. He was clearly there as his second guy. And remember, there was those pictures of him actually like waving and encouraging Bernal. Yeah. Everyone said, this is what you need a teammate for. Is the same thing likely if Thomas is dropped and Port and Carapaz are the ones with him? And yeah. They've only lost 20 seconds to him at that point in the race. And now Pogacar's gone off on the climb towards Teens or Luzard Eden or whatever. Now, so that's where it gets interesting, because there's no clear second supporter for those guys. Whereas Bernal had that. Because once you go beyond those three, they've got Gegenhardt, they've got some good guys.
Yeah, for sure.
But the way you could see it is when it comes down to the last five or six, it's those three, Pogacar, Roglic, Lopez.
Yeah.
Uran maybe. He was good in
great
good
time
in
trial.
The Tour of Switzerland, yeah. Good at the time trial. So anyway, the point is that depending on how this thing unfolds, that could become quite a nice sub-story as who leads Ineos.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to stick your neck out then on the Tour de France. Who's your pick?
I can't see beyond Pogacar. Like if he has a safe race, if it's true that he's in better shape than he was last year, Roglic is known unknown. I mean, that's what's so interesting about him. Mm. Like we know how he races these tours, but he hasn't raced for so long that you don't know. But I think it's those two guys. I don't think Ineos have the firepower to beat the two Slovenians. Mm. So I think it's the same as last year. And just because I think you'll say Pogacar, I'm going to say Roglic.
I'm going to say Richie Porte.
Oh, are you? Oh,
yeah. Okay. I know it's a bit of an outlier situation. Field. Left field. I think he's got a chance. I think he's got confidence. And we'll see. I mean, he's certainly... And if you look at the bookies, they will tell you that Pogacar and Roglic must be the big favourites. But I always like that guy that's sort of right behind them, because they might be fighting it out and Port just comes through and sneaks a couple of seconds here and there and while they're watching each other. So who knows?
Port
can be fascinating.
Yeah, you said just now, always guy, the nearly man. For him is if he can just get through without a bad day, then for sure. Port seems to me to always be a safe bet for a podium, but a risky bet for a win. It's one of those guys, you know. But then again, like Roglic is a safe bet for a podium anyway, and so is Pogacar.
Yeah.
And then again, Thomas. And anyway, I think it's a super competitive tour. And then, of course, Lopez. And by the way, there's this guy.
Marcel Woods is in there as well. He's also
Mark Padun, who nobody knew about 2 weeks ago. Yeah. This guy from Bahrain, Victoria, suddenly climbed the fastest ever on the Juplan, I think it was.
Yeah.
And the fastest ever on, what was the other one they did in the Dauphiné? He got in the break and he was out on his own and he still climbed it faster than the chasers. It was outrageous. Guy you'd never heard of, really.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting to see if he's got that same condition in the Tour de France. So there's a few outliers who could disrupt the race.
Yeah.
But if I had to give you the conservative estimate, it would be Pogacar. But I'll say Roglic just because
we like to be different.
Yeah, and I think last year he was the best guy over 3 weeks, and he was really not good over 1 hour. And then then we haven't even spoken. This year's tour is a proper King of the Mountains tour because it's got a lot of climbs that aren't going to be contested by the GC guys, but where you can rack up points, I think.
Yes.
So I think you'll see quite a competitive Polka-Dot-Jersey race.
Mm.
David Gaudu, maybe, if he's not in. See, he's going for the GC, but the polka dots will go to a guy who loses time early and then finds himself the luxury of breakaways to win the jersey. And then the green jersey, pick that.
Well, the green jersey is interesting because Sam Bennett's not riding for the Quick-Step.
That's right, so
they're
defending champions.
And they've chosen that old guy.
Yeah.
I think they call him Father Time now. Mark Cavendish is in that team. That's a very surprising
it's either very simple if you believe the story about a knee injury, or it's very complex if you read what his boss has said. So
yes, there's definitely no love lost between the bosses of De Koninck Quick Step and Sam Bennett.
Certainly not anymore.
Yeah, for sure.
So he's leaving the team. I mean, if he wasn't before, he definitely is now.
Yeah.
But his boss basically said he's not sure about the knee injury, in case you missed this, listeners. But he thinks it might just be that he's mentally, did he say mentally weak or not yeah. tough enough or something like
something
that?
Something like that, yeah.
But anyway.
He questioned his mental abilities.
Yeah. yeah. So no Bennett.
Yeah. yeah. So the defending champion in the green jersey is not going to be there, which is probably, that's an unusual thing to happen.
There's a couple of stages where like a Sargon will go on the tack, I reckon.
Yeah.
And he'll rack up 40 points, win the stage. Do it again a couple of days later, and that puts him out of sight because he'll come between third and fifth in every other finish line sprint.
Yeah.
So that'll be...
So maybe Sagan can win Sagan another maybe. Green jersey.
You know, yeah, the thing about Van Aert is I think he'll be committed to Roglic. So yeah. that takes him out of that one, because otherwise he's the guy who'll get in the breaks. I mean, if Sagan and Roglic... if Sagan and Van Aert are on a break and there's a Cat 3 climb, I know who I'm backing there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know, and then you got the pure sprinters who'll pick up stage wins, but I think will lose enough points.
Caleb Ewan,
those types. Yeah, so for sure. I think all the jerseys will be interesting, but it's such a backloaded tour that really, I was going to say we'll know in the first week, but we won't.
One thing I always love about the Tour de France is once we see a couple of the, you know, we look back on the sort of glory days of the 80s, the 90s, and all the grand champions that we've had on the tour, and you think, well, once those guys retire, I remember when Alberto Contador retired a couple of years ago, I thought, well, that's really the end of exciting grand tour racing, because he was a real animator. But, you know, arguably we're having more exciting racing than we've ever had in Grand Tour and cycling level, both in the classics, because we've got the Wout van Aerts and the Mathieu van der Poels and all those kind of riders participating. So it is exciting to watch. And every year there's a new bunch of youngsters coming up to take on the – and there'll no doubt be some surprises that we've never mentioned or even written about across the various websites that will come through. People say, we never heard of that guy.
I mean, there is a risk. You say when Contador retired, it get dull, and it did.
It did a bit.
I mean, there was a period there for a couple of years where it was this metronomic train at 6 watts a kilo.
Yeah.
And just the physiology of that, by the way, is if you're going at 6 and you're at the front and you're going to give a 15-minute effort, the guy behind you is benefiting a little bit. So he's at 5.9, he can do 20 minutes. The guy behind him is at 5.8, he'll do 25. Nobody's attacking off that pace because it's so close to everyone's functional threshold power or their steady state, or if you want to call it their W prime or whatever you want to call it, critical power, that you can't attack off that pace.
Yeah.
And it really neutralizes the race. And I think what's helped is Pogacar seems to attack off any pace, which is cool. And then the relative weakness of Ineos last year actually made cycling more entertaining.
Yeah.
And so the biggest concern, the biggest risk for a boring race is that Ineos just sticks 6 guys on the front and like just neutralize and crush resistance. Anyway, so I hope that doesn't happen.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
I think cycling's changed a lot in the last year because of COVID and all sorts of other things. There's lots of animators in there at the moment. And the Koenig always loved the flat stages. There's a bit of wind. Things pick up a bit there as well. So,
and then the pure climbers, you know, the Lopez we mentioned, Padun. I mean, these guys are going to lose minutes in the time trials, as we said. So they have to do something, and it goes uphill. So I think that will be interesting. So there'll be other stories. I mean, nutrition in the Tour is a fascinating topic.
Yeah.
How do you get in 4,000 calories a day in addition to your living expenditure?
Yeah.
So there's loads of cool things, interesting things to discuss.
And of course, you're taking on a challenge yourself on the Tour de France.
Don't publicize it. Because,
I'm going to have to publicize it because for those of you that follow Ross on Strava, you'll be able to see how he does. I think you've conservatively said you're going to try 50% of the Tour.
Every day.
And you're going to see how you feel after the first week. There's been lots of other people who are doing various things.
No. I'm not going to see how I feel. I'm going to go for
You're going to go for 21 days.
But if work, you see, this is the problem. It's like I've got work.
You're still going to work.
So when am I going to do these things? Like, I'm not going to sit on the indoor. I can see myself actually, if work gets busy, sitting on the indoor at 10 o'clock at night, riding until 1 in the morning. 120 Ks on the indoor. But
make sure you've got your chamois cream.
I'm looking out the window and the rain is flying sideways.
Yeah.
If this doesn't let up, I might not make the first weekend.
Exactly.
But anyway, I'm going to
try. It's interesting there because for us here on bicycling, there's a couple of people who are pushing various different iterations of a Tour de France challenge. So even something little as doing 10% of the Tour, I've done that a couple of times. It gives you a sense of what the riders go through, because you have your long days, your short days, your recovery days, the 2 Mondays that you have off.
Mm.
You get a sense of what your recovery has to be like every day. And for those of you that are looking for a little boost in your exercise, that regularity, and we talk about this often in our podcast, the consistency of riding 21 days in 3 weeks, no matter what that distance, whether it's an hour a day or in your case for like 4 hours a day.
Yeah, I'm bargaining on 3.5 hours a day average, yeah, which is
a lot. It's a lot.
So to be charitable, I should call it the 70% time of the Tour de France challenge. It makes it sound better than 50 of the distance, because I'm certainly not going to be averaging 37 k's an hour like they do.
No, 47 kilometers an hour times.
I think I looked actually, because I said I'm going to try to do 50% of the tour at 67% of the speed.
Right.
And I think they average 37, so I've got to hit 26. But
37 is the average across the whole tour, is it?
Yeah, the finishing by the time they reach Paris. But and then the other thing is, okay, there's boredom. Because the thing in Cape Town is we've got unbelievable routes, but only about 5 of them.
Yes.
because of the mountain, there's really only like 3 big roads. So you can only create like 6 combinations.
Mm.
And so after the 1,500th kilometer on the same stretch of road, I think that might be a problem. And then the other thing is like the nutrition, you know? And I'm interested to see how, like heart rate, for instance, when you start to like do hours and hours and hours, your heart rate gets suppressed because your sympathetic nervous system is, and your legs can't drive your heart. And so there's a few.
So there's a part of you that is experimenting with yourself a little bit, yeah.
I suspect
that. Have you got a nutrition plan?
A larger part of me. A lot of pasta.
A lot of pasta.
And
well, if you like Chris Froome, Froome says rice is better than pasta.
Okay.
He says you're either a rice guy or a pasta guy in the peloton. You're a pasta guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I've got to find people who are going to cook for me.
I don't cook,
especially the
volume. But you don't have the advantage of a masseur coming every day.
There's that. Yeah. My best mate's Richard's wife does massages. So I've booked her for the rest days.
Yes.
So that's going to be taken care of.
Right, good idea.
Anyway, now that you've told everyone about this, let me go and taper.
Well, I've committed to at least riding a couple of those days with you, so at least we can
have
somebody to ride with.
The boredom of doing them all, because I reckon if there's, what are the 19 riding days? And the other nice thing is,
riding days.
Well, there's 2 rest days. But because of the 2, yes, you're right. 21 stages. No. You're right. I forgot they start on the Saturday and end Sunday. The other cool thing is there's a time trial. Okay, so it's half for me. So it's 14.5K the first one.
Yeah.
And at the end, I do 15K. So that's basically an FTP.
Yes.
So I'll do an FTP at the start and end, and I'll see.
You're not going to go easy on those days. Just take a rest.
Those will be max efforts because
you want it to be like the tour.
Yeah, I want to see, and I want to see how much I drop off.
Okay.
Between the.
Are you going to check your weight?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm going to weigh body fat. I'm going to try and do as much as I can. Okay. Because like that's the fun of it.
Well,
for me.
We're definitely going to keep an eye on that because it'll be interesting to see what happens to you over the next.
It would be cool to measure. In fact, now that I'm saying it, I should actually try and get a blood test done, you know, and see if I can measure cortisol and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't want to spend thousands on a hobby. But
it's a good experiment. And I think
it'll be fun.
I'll be fascinated to listen to it. I'm sure most of our listeners will too.
Yeah, even though it is only, I mean, look, we talk about it, it's only 50%. But anyways.
Good luck with that. That's going to be great. So for those of you that are watching, if you're taking on your own Tour de France challenge or something along that sort of lines, you know, let us know on Twitter, whether it's 10% or 15% or 20% of the altitude or the distance. It's always fascinating to know how people take on these events in all different guises. But best of luck to all of you, and we look forward to the next month and a half of incredible action. There'll be lots to talk about, no doubt, and we'll be keeping up to date with all the stuff, the relevant stuff around the science of sport. But from us for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.